We're glad to be with you, and Sister Sharon and I rejoice to have fellowship here, looking forward to connecting personally with so many of you during the convention here, and as we might, the Lord provides. Our class in Portland send their love and greetings, especially with Isaiah 61, 1 and 2, which ends with the second verse as, "To proclaim the acceptable year of the Lord, the day of vengeance of our God, to comfort all that mourn," part of our wonderful commission. Well, then, our lesson today is Zion's hope. And our text is found in Isaiah 49, 22 and 23. "Thus saith the Lord, Behold, I will lift up my hand to the Gentiles, and set up my standard to the people, and they shall bring thy sons in their arms, and thy daughters shall be carried upon their shoulders. And kings shall be thy nursing fathers, and thy queens thy nursing mothers. They shall bow down to thee with their face toward the earth, and lick up the dust of thy feet, and thou shalt know that I am the Lord, and they shall be ashamed that wait for me." And Isaiah 30, verse 9, "For the people shall dwell in Zion and Jerusalem, shall weep no more. He shall be very gracious to thee at the voice of thy cry. When he shall hear it, he will answer thee." Now, brother, we may apply these words to spiritual Zion, yet they have a very real and primary application also to natural Israel. In the mid-1800s, there was a general refocusing of promises to the Jewish people. This was awakened by the resurgence of persecutions upon those peoples. The promises were at first considered some far distant hope. Then attention was focused on Christ's work at his return and the Messianic age. Soon, Pastor Russell came on the scene and saw the promises as belonging to a specific time with specific prophecies at the Second Advent. These subjects deal with the study of both chronology and prophecy. What we have today in volumes 2 and 3 is a synopsis of careful collaboration with contemporary students and review of historical materials. Brother Russell was not the first to pick up these elements of time and scripture, but his treatises were the first to place them in balance with other prophecies and a consistent chronology and the doctrines that comprise the divine plan of the ages. These subjects had been broached and even expanded to some extent by Nelson Barber in 1871 and earlier by William Miller and others beyond the Atlantic. Before these came such ones as Edward Irving and H.G. Guinness and Joseph Wolfe and Eliot, Henry Phineas Clinton, William Hales, Priestley, all of the 19th century. These in turn drew on the treatises of reformers and scholars before them, including Isaac Newton. All these knew that the return of favor to Israel would eventually have their blindness turned away, and that the crown of dominion held by the Gentiles was for a limited time. They also knew these subjects were connected with the second coming of the Messiah. Therefore, to understand the time of his return, they knew they must deal with the prophecies for Israel. For when he comes, whose right it is, he will reclaim the kingdom with Israel and depose the Gentiles, Ezekiel 21:27. But best minds, the best minds of the time, could only produce straws in the wind without the key of the object and the manner of this second advent. More than this, the background of the plan with the fall, the ransom, restitution, the sin offering, the body of Christ, and all the other beautiful truths were necessary to frame the picture and recognize the place of these prophecies. Others had thought to measure and count the years and numbers, supposing such cleverness could discover some code in these prophecies. But the answer had to wait for two factors. First, the due time, for the wise to understand at the time of the end, Daniel 12. Secondly, God only reveals his deep things by his Spirit. The God of heaven reveals secrets to his servants, and no others will understand so clearly and so thoroughly. Interpretations belong to God, and he is the revealer of secrets. After laying out the plan in Volume 1, Brother Russell treats the biblical timeline in Volume 2. Next, in the same volume, he treats the times of the Gentiles. Later in Volume 2, he explains the Jewish Mishnah, or double. Then in Volume 3, he explains the process of returning Israel to favor and their promised kingdom role as part of the Abrahamic and New Covenants. Now notice Herzl's work that followed that of Brother Russell. Incidentally, it may be inferred that Herzl had some indirect influence even by Brother Russell's writing. Brother Russell wrote Volume 3 in 1890. Herzl produced The Jewish State in 1896. Brother Russell's presentation is orderly, and it is necessary to understand these matters. We cannot understand the future ages until we understand Israel's past and period of favor, and why they were set aside, or why the dominion was given over to the Gentiles, and what God has in store for both Israel and the nations. When I was a young man, I had little understanding of these things. Even having heard astute elders expound the prophecies, until I sat down and carefully considered the pen of the Laodicean messenger. I remember learning how God gave Israel his law and the prophets, preparing them to be a light among the Gentiles, Isaiah 49, verse 6. We saw the courage of Israel's prophets and their judges when they nobly and when the nobility and potential of the first kings like Saul and David and Solomon prevailed. But then followed their apostasy and their compromise. Some kings were good, some were bad. But finally, all the remaining kings were wicked. We remember the explanation that the power, the crown of Israel, was removed, but that the promise, the scepter, the right to rule, held for a future day, Genesis 49, verse 10. Yet the kingdom was taken from Israel, and the wicked king Zedekiah, and dominion was taken from him and the nation, and given to the Gentiles, beginning with Nebuchadnezzar. But the ray of hope was preserved for Israel when we learned the subjection under these Gentiles was for a particular time, the Gentile times, for a limited and definite duration. It was all foretold in Leviticus chapter 26 and forecast even in Daniel the fourth chapter and Ezekiel 21 and picked up in the New Testament by Luke chapter 2 verse 24. If Israel's dominion was wayward, would the Gentile rule with more equity and justice? And would Israel, as a people of faith, be lost under the Gentile crowns? Well, to the first question, we see that the Gentiles were no better and even worse than the people that he first favored. When their eyes are opened to earth's new king, no mouth will claim that the Gentiles were more righteous than the Jewish people nurtured under the law. And to the second question, Israel's place in God's program, we have discovered that God preserved the people of promise even while exiled among the Gentiles, as we learn in Romans the third chapter and in Romans the 11th chapter. When did the Gentile times begin and for how long? Jerusalem was the center for kings and priests. It was elevated to the sacred place under David and Solomon, and sanctified by God's blessing of the Ark of the Covenant in the temple on Mount Moriah. Even when Jesus was asked by the Samaritan woman if worship should be from Samaria or from Jerusalem, Jesus put his seal on the Jews from Jerusalem in John 4, chapter 20 and 22. Verse 20 and 22. From such perspective, Brother Russell recognized that only when Jerusalem was burned and the population deported to the Gentile province of Babylon for longer than 50 years, the duration of the Jubilee, would the Gentile times begin. The torch of Nebuchadnezzar not only burned the temple on the ninth of Av, Jeremiah 39 verse 2, but the city and autonomy itself was burned. The remnant of Israel were evicted from Jerusalem for 70 years, until King Cyrus decreed their liberty to return to Jerusalem. However, for 2,520 years, the Jews remained under the decreed Gentile dominion. Scriptures in Leviticus and Daniel decreed this subjection was for seven times, or 2,520 years. We are convinced this dominion began with the year 606 BC, and probably the destruction occurred in the fall of 607, the autumn, and extended 2,520 years later to the very day on the 9th of Av in 1914, when war was declared on August 1st. The precision of prophecy not only was marked in time, but was also marked in events. God allowed the Gentile torch to be set upon the kingdoms of this world, just as the symbol of Israel's dominion was taken away 2,520 years before, seven times earlier. And now God set the torch of fire to the kings of Europe and the symbol of Gentile kingdoms. A few weeks ago, the First World War debt by Germany, the reparations were just finished being paid. And I'd like to play a little video clip.
Now for our What in the World segment. Today is a remarkable day. It marks the official end of a very long war, 91 years old. If you do the math, that gets you to 1919, the Treaty of Versailles. That's when you thought World War I ended. Actually, the book finally closes on World War I today. The Treaty of Versailles did end the fighting, but it didn't end the war. One condition of the treaty was Germany had to pay reparations. And today, Germany makes its last payment, about $95 million. All this might seem a world away, but in my view, World War I is the event that created the modern world. Think about it. Before the world was run by a small group of European empires that were themselves monarchies. Think of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, the German Empire, the Russian Empire, the Ottoman Empire, all multinational, all monarchies. The war overturned all of them and created new nations and new governments that were legitimized by modern principles. Nationalism, democracy, socialism, communism. Without World War I, no collapse of the Russian monarchy and no rise of Lenin. And certainly no collapse of the German monarchy and thus no rise of Hitler and thus no World War II. The society that came out of the war, soldiers, politicians, merchants, businessmen, is of course the modern society we live in today. The emergency needs of a massive war created the modern state, with new powers like the power of taxation of income, nationalization of industry, regulation of various aspects of life. You see, before World War I, the state everywhere was very limited in scope and size. Afterwards, everywhere, the state saw itself as responsible for society in some sense. World War I also created modern total war. Before that, European warfare had tended to be fought with rules and traditions, almost like medieval battles. Soldiers fought, but civilians were protected. They fought on battlefields, leaving cities alone. They fought during the day and slept during the night. World War I exploded all these restraints. And we still live in that age of total war today, without limits, where everything and everyone is fair game. We are understandably moved by the loss of more than 4,000 American soldiers in Iraq. Consider, however, that in the first 6 days of a single skirmish, the German offensive of 1918, British forces suffered 300,000 casualties in World War I. The war caused the collapse of many empires with consequences that continue to haunt us today. It meant, for example, the end of the Ottoman Empire, which had sided with Germany, and the creation of the modern Middle East. The creation, for example, of Iraq, with a Kurdish north, a Shiite south, and a Sunni middle. So anywhere you look, you will find that you are still living in the world created by World War I. So in a sense, it's appropriate that it's actually been with us all these decades, only ending finally today.
No, this was only a few weeks ago. Germany just finished paying the reparations for World War I. And as this commentator has said, the world changed and we are living in a world that was created by World War I. Not only has the world changed, but the mighty Ottoman Empire fell into the fire. The map of Europe was redrawn, and Turkey's dominion over Jerusalem fell. And divine providence arranged that by the end of the war, Jerusalem and the land was declared a homeland for Jews. From the Ottoman Empire to the British Mandate, in scarcely 5 years, changed the whole course of history. Such a momentous prophecy could only be mandated by the return and presence of Earth's new king. Such things are not the chance of history, but manipulated by a divine finger and mandated by divine authority. Now, what of the double of favor and disfavor?
For one slide off.
And return a favor for Israel. This was a different prophecy from the Gentile times, but it was also a pointer to the work of a new king, prerequisite to the blessing that flow from the new king to natural Israel, and eventually from spiritual Israel to natural Israel, and through them to all who will come to the mountain of the house of the Lord. If the prophecies pointing to the return of Christ had been reached, then we should see a conjunction of the prophecies concerning Israel. Though the Jewish double had been treated to some extent by earlier scholars, Brother Russell treats more than the numbers. I first read the parallel dispensations about 1958 to 1960 and realized that he treated the biblical premise in a way that few others had touched. He supplies the scripture's evidence, and you probably have many more noted in your margins. Here are a few of the profound statements found in this chapter in Volume 2. Volume 2, page 201. We won't take time to read so much of these as we had a little bit of a late start. But he says on page 201, "The whole Jewish system as divinely instituted shows that in all its features, it was typical of the then dawning Christian dispensation, mapping out most clearly the course of the Christian church of the gospel age." This theme continues on page 203 and 204. Then on page 209, there is this little quote. "Not only were fleshly Israel and its ceremonies typical, but the Jewish age was typical of the gospel age. They are of exactly the same length and correspond to each other." All this invited our close attention, an examination of the scriptures offered, and to search even for additional evidences. The time evidence is rather simple and straightforward. God's favor continued exclusively with natural Israel for 1845 years, from the death of Jacob until the cross, just 3.5 years after the presence of Christ, the Messiah, at his first advent. A parallel rejection was decreed from there for another 1845 years, reaching to the year 1878. I remember marking in my Bible the text that marked the prophet's vantage point from the beginning, from the middle, and the end of this double, namely Jeremiah 16, and Zechariah 9, and Matthew 23, and Isaiah 40, and Isaiah 61, and Isaiah 65. We call the parallels a secondary evidence because they are predicted on a reliable chronology line that is regarded as primary. But in importance, they are not necessarily secondary. They confirm other parts of the chronology. We picked up some of these quotes, also from Volume 2, page 196. "If not of divine arrangement and intended for our instruction, how and why come the double proofs, matching and corroborating each other so perfectly?" He says, try it. Prove it. Suppose either a mistake or a change of one of the 19 jubilees kept by Israel was missed more or less. In page 242, he says, "The full force of this parallelism is not obtained unless it be noticed that the jubilee cycles and the Gentile times mark the periods which correspond so exactly with these of the Jewish parallels. Are these time correspondences mere accidents, or are they of the same divine ordering?" Many years ago, I was impressed with the balance of the equality of things. So about 1970, I took up Brother Russell's challenge to prove it and try it. So I made a small computer program to test different points of the jubilees, and different endings for 6,000 years to see if some other parallel could find a conjunction with the first advent. So I first proposed a fixed factor of 606 BC and the years from Adam to Jacob and, of course, Jesus' death, and found that there was no other parallel than 1845 years, beginning with 1813, can be found. We, of course, now see that some of those premises that I assumed then, like 606 BC and other points, have been called into question. But we are not convinced of the revisions, and we are not intending to go through the details of this, but just to mention that if you make certain assumptions, you will come to the precise same conclusion. Brother Russell goes on to focus on what occurred in 1878, at the end of the Jewish double and beginning of the return of favor. Our view of history should not be blurred with the passing of time. He says on page 213 of volume 2, "Now for the exact date of the return of favor to Israel, which marks the exact end of the heavenly call, from which date Israel will begin gradually to see and to have increasing evidence of returning favor." And he continues on page 218. "We should expect some evidence of God's returning favor to fleshly Israel in or about 1878. This we do find in the fact that the Jew is now permitted privileges in Palestine denied him for past centuries. And it was in that very year, 78, when their double was full, that the Berlin Congress of Nations was held, in which Lord Beaconsfield, a Jew, then Prime Minister of England, was the central figure and took the leading part. There, England assumed a general protectorate over the Asiatic provinces of Turkey, among which is Palestine," and we will not continue the quote. I think you're familiar with these things. On these things moved us greatly when we saw this historical evidence. We found that the first Jewish settlement, Petah Tikva, the Gate of Hope, was established in this very year of 1878. Zionism and immigration spread from that year onward. The struggle was not easy, and the world was in transition. The significance of 1878 may be lost to public attention today, but not to the pages of history. From this time forward, it is easy to trace the gradual turning of divine intervention. The next step was the Balfour Declaration in 1917. To supplant Turkey's role in the Middle East, Britain declared their intention to create a national homeland for the Jews. Despite ulterior motives, God determined that the declaration would prevail. Even with periods of restricted immigration, the divine mandate could not be overridden. Jews came by the hundreds, and then by the thousands, and then by the millions. The land was cleaned, watered, planted, harvested. So many leaders have been secular Jews, there has remained an element committed to the promise of Abraham. Neither wars nor world opinion has turned them out of the land. There remains some severe lessons for the Jewish people to learn, and perhaps not all the Jews have even returned in our day yet. In history, they're going to Egypt for help, or forging alliances with foreigners, never brought them deliverance or holiness in the past. The present quagmire with the Palestinians results from never having fully evicted the enemies of the law when they first entered Canaan, or fully giving their hearts over
to the divine will and promises. The world now accuses Israel of racism and ethnic cleansing. But it is not a matter of Arabs or Philistines not having more than adequate homelands beyond the borders. We call them Philistines because that seems to be their ancient heritage. The problem expanded more recently in the Oslo Accords, where modern leaders sought peace by dividing the promised land with those that were committed to Israel's demise. Israel's law provided for equitable treatment of foreigners and strangers who were willing to abide by the laws of the land, but not to accommodate destructionists. So it will be under the new law covenant. Brethren watching the return of Zion have a few questions on how the final scenes will play out in prophecy. The ending of the double has not left Israel merely to their own devices, but has followed a recovery plan that much parallels the steps of their decline. But does God intend to attach his blessings with the present Israeli government? Will peace be achieved through negotiations? Will Arab and Muslim demands be retracted and replaced with assent to Jewish rights in their homeland? Will Israel receive the greater land promised before or after Ezekiel 38 and Zechariah 12? Well, one thing is sure. God's favor is not because they are great among the nations, or because they have had such a record of holiness. His favor is first because of the Father's faith. Then it is because that his promise is sure and irrevocable, Deuteronomy 7, 6 through 9. Then it is because the people of the book have been returned and tutored by the oracles of God, Romans 3, verse 2. Even here, the nation will need to look to their ancient prophets and contemporary faithful remnant among them. Today, Muslims are the largest and fastest growing religious segment in the world today. Jews are the smallest, and their percentage of humanity has even halved, cut in half, since Brother Russell published Volume 1 and that chart you remember in the front of Volume 1. However, God has chosen the weak things of the world to confound the things which are mighty. As of 2009, Muslim population was 23% of humanity. Jewish population, less than a quarter of 1%. So consider Deuteronomy 7, 7 through 9. The Lord did not set his love upon you, nor choose you because you were more in number than any people, for ye were the fewest of all people. But because the Lord loved you, and because he would keep his oath, which he has sworn unto your fathers, hath the Lord brought you out with a mighty hand, and redeemed you out of the house of bondmen from the hand of Pharaoh, king of Egypt. Know therefore that the Lord thy God, he is God, faithful God, which keepeth covenant and mercy with them that love him and keep his commandments to a thousand generations. Brethren, we want to highlight how God is using the small, the insignificant things of the earth to humble and bless the mighty. And you too are the remnant, the few among humanity. We want to return to Petatikva, the valley of Achor, the gate of hope, Hosea 2, verse 15. Petatikva was the first Jewish settlement in 1878. It has now blossomed into a thriving city of more than 200,000 in population. It is now the second largest industrial sector in Israel after the northern city of Haifa. It may be little known that their major industry is Teva Pharmaceuticals. They supply the world with medical aid for Parkinson's disease, Alzheimer's, multiple sclerosis, MS, prostate cancer, Crohn's disease, ALS, and Hansen's disease, leprosy. And many more engaging neurological and oncology products delivered worldwide. Teva in Petatikva is the world's largest maker of generic drugs, serving a world of a few friends and many more foes and enemies as well. Teva recently purchased two major European drug companies for more than $10 billion. Many Teva affordable generics, however, are blocked by American giants like Pfizer and Eli Lilly. Protecting their own profits. Brethren, these are not kingdom restitution cures. We don't propose that they are. But many people who are the least in the earth today are being prepared and they are learning how to reach out and bless humanity and even those who hate them. Now in Romans 11 is Apostle Paul's masterpiece of reasoning and prophecy concerning Israel. He first reasons that they were set aside to make way for special favor turned to a faithful remnant among the Gentiles. He then shows this does not annul God's promise and favor to the people that he foreknew. He then connects their return to favor with life from the dead. This is one of the reasons that Brother Russell began to think about the resurrection of the sleeping saints also in 1878. Then Paul explains that natural Israel will be grafted in again to the Abrahamic olive tree covenant, not by their old law covenant, but by the new covenant made with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah, Jeremiah 31:31. Though he puts no time prophecy or parallelism on this, he says their final stage of favor, turning away their blindness, must wait for the full number of the Gentiles to be selected, Romans 11, 25. But in the ages to come, we may look back and find this too was foreknown by God. The great timetable keeper, as clearly as the duration of the Gentile dominion and the turning of the tide of favor for Israel. Now Apostle Paul continues his analogy with spiritual and natural Israel in Romans 11:28 and 29. From the English Standard Version, we read, as regards the gospel, they are enemies for your sake. But as regards the election, they are favored for the sake of their forefathers. Why? Because the gifts and callings of God are irrevocable. The period of alienation was the second part of their double, during which the gospel has gone to the Gentiles, those who were of the faith of Abraham, therefore the extended seed of Abraham. But then he is careful to add that concerning their election, God's choice, God is still honors his calling to natural Israel, the natural seed of Abraham. Is this really what he means? Yes. We read in Romans 4, verse 16. To the end the promise might be sure to all the seed, not to that only which is from the law, but to that also which is of the faith of Abraham, who is the father of us all. All the seed refers to both those who come from the Mosaic law, the Jew, and those who are of the faith of Abraham, also the Gentile. Of course, faith is common to both. But his point is that the promise included both natural and spiritual, both sand and stars. And here in Romans chapter 11, he stresses that though the natural was set aside during the gathering of the church, they are still part of the original Abrahamic seed of blessing. Paul draws on this in the prophecy of Amos 9, verse 9. For lo, I will command, and I will sift the house of Israel among all nations, like as corn is sifted in the sieve, yet shall not the least grain fall to the earth. The seed is not forgotten and is not lost. It is sure to both the sand and the stars, because through your mercy, they also shall obtain mercy. The Lord add his blessing.